Thank you all for coming on such a fine day and at this stage in the term. I frequently have much smaller audiences than this, usually when I'm singing in the shower, but never mind. What I want to talk about today is a little bit of a move from the previous lectures in the series, which I think started out really with somebody thinking about creativity from a psychological point of view, and then two more lectures which were still pretty much focused around the idea of individual creativity and individual engagement with creative acts. And what I want to talk about today is creativity at a very different kind of level. I want to talk about societal innovation, about creativity as a large-scale social process bringing about big changes. And my excuse for doing this is the climate change issue. In 2007, I co-authored a paper which was called The Wrong Trousers. The title was inspired by our friends here, Wallace and Gromit. And in this paper, my co-author, Gwyn Prins from the London School of Economics, and I tried to engage in what we thought was a creative reframing of the way in which climate policy is thought about. The conventional way in which people have been thinking about climate change that's embodied in the Kyoto architecture, in our view, remains pretty much an end-of-the-pipe mode of dealing with pollution. It thinks of climate as a pollution problem, an environmental problem, and it's about stopping the dirty stuff coming out of the end of the pipe. We now have national pipes, they're called national emissions targets, but it's still very much that mode. And we wanted to try to reformulate the way in which people were thinking about climate change and climate change policy, largely because we felt that this approach wasn't going anywhere. The starting point of our argument was that Kyoto was based on three fundamentally misleading analogies with other environmental problems. And those were respectively the stratospheric ozone issue, the sulfur pollution issue from power stations, and this one surprises a lot of people, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. These were three fairly recently negotiated international agreements around the time that the Kyoto Protocol was being formulated. They seem to offer analogies that would lead us as a society in the direction of effective policies to deal with an air pollution problem, the emission of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So, of course, it was very appealing framing the issue in that way to think about what had happened with stratospheric ozone, which caused the famous ozone hole. And this was itself caused by the emissions of chlorofluorocarbons, a chemical which actually depletes ozone in the upper atmosphere. And this was dealt with by an international treaty which initially sought to phase out the production of these gases and subsequently, through various amendments to the treaty, in fact, banned their production altogether. And it was deemed to be a remarkable success. The architecture for this was basically to put in place what was called a framework convention and then a series of implementation protocols, of which the Montreal Protocol is the most famous. Very appealing analogy, right? It sort of feels like climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. The only problem is the analogy isn't really a very good one because you only had a very small number of companies in a small number of countries producing chlorofluorocarbons. It was only one gas. It was an artificial gas. And there was a readily available technological substitute for it that could easily be put into air conditioners and used as foam expanders and applied to the other kinds of things that chlorofluorocarbons were used for. The second analogy, the sulfur trading program, this was really when the neoclassical economists got in on the act in the tail end of the 1980s and persuaded President Bush Sr. That climate change really needed an economically efficient solution and that we should do this through the market. And indeed, there have been the recent example of the sulfur trading program of the Environmental Protection Agency in the US, which allowed electric utilities in the states to trade sulfur emissions among themselves. Why did they want to do that? Well, it was to do with it was ultimately to allow West Virginians, represented by Senator Byrd, to continue to burn dirty brown coal in West Virginia and other places in the eastern United States, rather than to have to ship in by train large quantities of clean coal from the western states. So it was a way of saving money for the eastern utilities and allowing coal mining to continue. It worked very well, however. Utilities were able to trade their sulfur emissions allowances in an exchange, in a market, and it did indeed result in significant reductions in the sulfur burden in the airshed over the United States. The only problem is, again, it's not a very good analogy because we're talking about a small number of traders, electric utilities, small number of large traders, in fact, trading a single gas, sulfur dioxide, and doing so within the legal framework of a single nation state, that of the United States of America. So there's a legal framework. If you imagine trying to do this internationally, say you're trading with Russia and Russia decides it's going to violate its cap, there's not really much that you could think of in the way of a sanction that you could realistically impose on defaulters in that situation. Maybe not such a good analogy. The third one was the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. And I say people are surprised by this, but that's because they forget that Al Gore, before he was a climate wonk and an environment wonk, was actually a national security wonk. And he was very much involved as a senator in the design of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. And it was, in fact, his chief of staff, Leon Firth, who carried the ideas of mutually verifiable reductions from the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty into the climate architecture. Again, an appealing idea that countries should reduce their emissions in a verifiable way that they could check with each other in a staged fashion. But whereas it's quite easy for countries to monitor each other's nuclear warheads, and they're directly under the control of governments, of course, when we're talking about carbon emissions, we're talking about something which is much less easy to do the accounting for, and which was going to prove controversial, as we know, in the last round of climate talks, where China basically objected to the kinds of verification and monitoring measures that the United States wanted to introduce. So we felt that these were really quite misleading analogies, and we figured we needed a reframing, a creative act, first creative act really to be thinking about here, which is to think about a different set of trousers. You know the story of Wallace and Gromit, of course. Wallace, the inventor, invents the trousers that he uses to help him automate his dog walking, and the evil penguin Feathers McGraw substitutes a different set of trousers, which leads Wallace off in directions he doesn't want to go. And we felt that's actually what was happening with the Kyoto Protocol. It was leading to all kinds of abuses in terms of things like the Clean Development Mechanism, where we had factories being built in China to make refrigerants in order to generate emissions of certain gases with very, very high global warming potential, so that they could then claim CDM credits for incinerating and destroying those gases. So we had all kinds of perverse incentives introduced by that way. The other thing that we felt was really important was, as I alluded at the beginning, that in a way, thinking about climate change as an environmental issue is itself a misframe. It's actually, from the point of view of the mitigation of greenhouse gases, we felt it was a technological change issue. It's a technology problem rather than an environmental problem. So the first step was to think about how we could reframe mitigation through induced technological change. And the second and third steps were to think about adaptation, which has not been taken terribly seriously in this context. And finally, about a new set of policy approaches, remediation through very big new technology ideas called geoengineering. Now, what's the scale of the problem that we're facing? Very briefly, many of you may have seen this graph before. It's the so-called stress scenarios produced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It shows a set of projections that were made about 10 years ago, projections of world carbon emissions under various different sets of assumptions about economic development and technological development. And as you can see, the projections forward here range from a warming in 100 years' time of somewhere between 1 degree and 6 degrees Celsius. Now, the bad news about this graph is that we are actually on the top of this curve. Global emissions are increasing by about 3% per annum. So we are headed, if this is correct, towards about a 2 degree warming by the middle of the century and a 4 degree warming by the end of the century. But that's not all the bad news, I'm afraid, because the IPCC, when it developed these scenarios, made two assumptions, or assumed rather, I should say, that two trends that had been in place for about 100 years were going to continue. For the last 100 years, the carbon intensity and the energy intensity of production on the planet has gone down. In other words, per unit of GDP that we produce worldwide, for about 100 years, the amount of energy that goes into that unit of GDP and the amount of carbon embodied in that unit of GDP was declining. And about 3 years ago, that inflected, that changed, and started to rise. Now, you could dismiss this, as some of my colleagues on the IPCC did, as just a glitch or an anomaly, or you can see this is the beginning of a trend. What kind of a trend do you think it might be? India and China, modernizing, basically. Now, if the decline of energy and carbon intensity continues, we could actually find that we don't just have to reduce carbon emissions from the top of that red band to the bottom of that red band, but we might have to actually reduce from the top of the light blue band to the bottom of that red band. In other words, the size of the emissions reduction challenge may be 3 times larger than the IPCC has estimated it to be, if that trend continues, and we know, of course, trend is not destiny. But I just want to give you some idea of the magnitude of the kinds of challenge that we're facing with emissions mitigation. Now, I've said that I think that we need to reframe this part of the climate problem as a technology innovation problem. Why is that? Well, there's this thing called the Kaya identity. I don't actually have the math to do the top part, so I've simplified it to the expression here. Emissions basically equal the population times the wealth times the technology that they're using. That's a rough approximation of the mathematics above there. Now, if you think about what levers you have to pull on in terms of climate policy, according to this formula, you've got 3. You've got population, wealth, and technology. Persuading people that we need a smaller population is popular in certain political circles. However, if we're looking to make a change in the carbon concentrations in the atmosphere by mid-century, we'd actually have to start killing people. Because by the time, you know, just birth control methods fed through to 2040, we're already past that point. So we'd actually have to kill people, and the people we'd have to kill is us, not anonymous brown people living somewhere else. Not likely to be a big flyer in any democratic Western society. So population's not much of a winner. What about wealth? Well, trying to persuade people to be poorer probably isn't a particularly successful political policy stage to stand on. We know perfectly well, we've heard from repeated utterances in the US, that the United States is not willing to compromise the American dream and the American way of life. And certainly, I think most of us in this room would welcome the improvements in the standard of living of people in India and China, and would actually like to see them get wealthier. So that really only leaves us with technology. I hate to use the expression, there's no alternative. It reminds me of a politician I was never terribly fond of. But nevertheless, I think in this case, we're pretty close to having to say that. So we need to have technological innovation on a massive scale if we're thinking about going from the top of that light blue area in the histogram I showed just now to the bottom of the red. So where does technological innovation come from? We're accustomed to thinking about new inventions, and certainly in the popular imagination, they've always been ascribed to individuals. And so, you know, you ask people about innovation, invention, and the first name most people come up with, 2 names, Edison and Ford. And indeed, it appears in some ways that they fit this example. This is a quotation from Edison's obituary in the New York Times in 1931. And you can see here, of course, this whole notion of the solitary genius who was producing the light bulb with the light bulb in the top of his head. Unfortunately, though, if we look at the picture, the photograph here, this is Edison's, you could describe it as his laboratory, his workshop in Menlo Park, New Jersey. And the first thing you see is actually it's populated by several people. There's lots of gadgets and gizmos in there. There's a lot going on. This was, in fact, a factory or a workshop. Even at this level, innovation is a collective enterprise. Edison, with his team, aimed to produce 2 or 3 inventions a month and something really big and exciting once a quarter. I don't think he quite got that far, but this was the kind of thing. It was industrial scale innovation. And in that respect, in fact, it's not unlike the artist workshops of the Renaissance, where you actually had people working as a collective activity, grinding paint, assistants painting parts of paintings, and so on and so forth. And we tend to think of artistic enterprise, if anything, as being an individual act of creativity. And I think that if we think back to that period, we realise it's not. It's kind of ironic in a way that at the same period, by the way, parenthetically, we tend to think historically about individual gentlemen scientists producing scientific ideas, and then come into the modern era and think about big workshop-style kinds of science in laboratories. But both of these are probably mythologies. Another point to make is that inventions are not just social processes. Innovation isn't just a social process. Inventions themselves have histories. Everybody knows that Edison invented the light bulb, only he didn't. There was a whole series of innovations which happened prior to his unveiling the light bulb in 1879. The other thing is that innovation is system building. Innovators, when people are engaged in innovation, you're not really just about building a light bulb. Producing a light bulb was nothing. What Edison had to do was also produce a generating system, an electrical distribution system, and so on and so forth, in order that key element, the light bulb, actually had any would have any demand or would have any functionality. This is, I think, a quotation from, as I say, this is a quotation from Henry Ford, in fact, disavowing the idea altogether that there was individual genius involved. And he's basically saying, I'm a bricoleur. I got lots of bits of stuff that was lying around and I put it together and I made something out of it. So let's just think about a couple of unplanned systems. The internet is probably one of them. Not all of these are put together by single individuals. Some of them just come into being. One of my favourites actually is this technology on the right here, the siphon-operated flushing toilet. And we think about this, really, this is a ubiquitous piece of kit. You'd hardly expect to go into any civilised building and not find one of these, or at least a more modern version of it. I just thought this one was more picturesque. And it's a yardstick of development, in fact, in much of the developing world. Where, you know, is there a flushing toilet there? And we measure development by the number of metres of pipe that a country lays in a year in some instances. How did this come into being? What happened here? Well, what happened here was that a guy called Thomas Crapper invented this particular piece of kit, the siphon-operated flushing toilet, around the same time that other public health engineers were piping water into new industrial cities and burying sewers that would previously been open to the air. And these weren't related planned activities. But if you think about it for a moment, if the sewers hadn't been put underground, largely as a way of ridding the world of typhoid, and at the same time, waterborne diseases, at the same time fresh water being piped into cities, you wouldn't have had this technology. It wouldn't have been able to be adopted. You had to have both the water supply and the means of disposing of the waste from the bottom here. But this was the thing that linked those two bits of infrastructure together and then locked us into a technology by which, by the way, to this day, we continue to purify billions of gallons of water to drinking quality, only to flush 40% of it down toilets. It's a system that nobody in their right mind would have designed. It's insane. And yet we're locked into it. We can't get out of it. And that's something I want to talk more about in just a moment. The other point I want to make is the way in which innovations, societal innovations, technological innovations, stabilise what are called very heterogeneous elements to produce new technical fields. I mean, that's social science talk. But what it really means is that we pull things from different areas and put them together to make them into a technology. If you think at the current moment, the way in which nanotechnology was stabilised as a particular field, out of a whole range of technical practices, which included miniaturization of electronic components, molecular engineering, certain areas of microbiology, and so on and so forth. Technical fields that ostensibly had nothing in common with each other except size. And indeed, these were put together largely through the efforts of people in the US National Science Foundation, a guy called Mikhail Rocco. And some critics have said, actually, nanotechnology is a federal budget category. It's not really a technology at all, because it's really an assemblage of things, but it enabled innovators and people who were working in these various technological fields to mobilize resources behind the development of that technology. And this is just once again a more historical and quaint example that in fact the Model T Ford owed a great deal to Mark Brunel, that was Isambard Kingdom Brunel's father, introducing mass production of tackle blocks for sailing ships for the English Navy, combining that with ideas from Carl Benz, who patented the first motor car in 1883. It didn't look much like a motor car. It looked like a couple of bicycles lashed together with a sailboat tiller on it and a lawnmower motor, but you know that's what it was. And then Olds, the American Ransom Olds, patents the auto assembly line, and hey presto, Ford comes and pulls all these things together, and you get the Model T Ford, and the rest, as they say, is history. Now, I promised to talk a little bit about, having suggested that innovation, technological innovation is a highly socialized process, it's very heterogeneous, it's about bringing things together, it's highly creative, sometimes it's directed, sometimes it's very spontaneous. But the main point is that it's socially embedded. And of course, you all recognize the sequence of letters on the screen behind me, right? It's the English standard keyboard. Why do we have that sequence of letters in the top line of the English standard keyboard? It was to slow typists down because typists were typing too fast. So, and the keys were jamming on the keyboard. When I first went to work at the Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee in 1984, I had one of these things on my desk. It's an IBM Selectric. You notice this doesn't have keys. Within 3 or 4 years, I had one of these on my desk, an Apple II, which bears even less resemblance to a typewriter with keys. So why do we still have this sequence of letters on the top line of our keyboards? Well, partly it's because we're used to it, but partly, so that's part of the social embedding, but there were other things as well. Because once you had typewriters, people invented typewriting courses, secretarial schools, touch typing techniques, so on and so forth. And so actually then moving away from this now completely redundant configuration became something that would be difficult to achieve. And so this is the phenomenon that social scientists call technological lock-in. Now, I can't resist this example. You all recognize the space shuttle, right? It's coming to the end of its life as a program. Those things on the side, those are boosters. Okay, they're made by Morton Thiokol. The reason why those boosters are that size is because of the size of the ass on that horse. Okay? Why are the boosters that size? The boosters are that size, as I say, they were made by Morton Thiokol in the Midwest. They had to be moved to Florida for the launch. They had to go through on the railroads. They had to go through railroad tunnels. So the maximum size they could be was the size of an American railroad tunnel. Now, the size of the railroad tunnel is determined in large part by the size of the gauge of the tracks. And the gauge of the tracks of American railroads are, in fact, was it 4'7½", something, I forget the exact distance now. But basically, the same gauge as the English standard railroad gauge. Why is the English standard railroad gauge that width? Well, because the rail tracks that were used in mines before the invention of the railroad for hauling coal out of coal mines had that gauge. Why did those have that gauge? Well, they had that gauge because carts, axles, actually were of that length. Why were cart axles of that length as a standard? Well, that was the medieval standard cart width because of Roman roads. It was to do with the ruts in the roads. You didn't want a cart that was going to be slipping off the road surface into the rut, breaking the wheels and that kind of thing. Why were the ruts that far apart on the Roman road? Because, of course, the Roman road ruts were made by Roman war chariots. Why was the axle length of a Roman war chariot the length it was? Well, that was determined by the fact that it was pulled by two horses side by side. So it had to accommodate two horses' butts, okay? So the reason why that piece of high-tech kit there is the size it is was determined by the width of a Roman horse's butt. Okay? And that's a phenomenon we call path dependency. So you can imagine now what some of the challenges are about innovation, is that it's not just about inventing new things, it's about getting rid of old things. It's about breaking away from technical lock-in and from path dependency. Very mundane bits of kit can have huge global effects. I'm betting Jonathan recognises this building. Anybody else recognise it? It's Lutyens' gorgeous building. It's the UK Embassy in Washington, D.C. And until the 1940s, British diplomats got hardship pay for postings to Washington. Anybody know why? I lived there for 9 years, but anybody know why? It's because of the summer weather. It is very hot, muggy, humid, and unpleasant. So what happened in the 1940s? Why did British diplomats lose hardship pay for Washington postings? You know, I'm gonna have to say, you're not allowed to answer any more questions, Jasper. air conditioning, okay? It was when air conditioning was put into this building. And so they lost the hardship pay. This was the kind of piece of kit. This is the end to misery of British diplomats. But of course, it didn't stop there. The invention of the air conditioner fundamentally transformed the entire geography of the southern United States and many other places. So this sort of sleepy little place in about the 1910s in the top left became this vast sprawling metropolis by the present day. That's Atlanta, Georgia, the New York of the South, one of the fastest growing urban areas in the whole of the United States. Not only did it change geography, it's had an impact on global architecture. No longer were buildings being tailored to fit particular kind of climatic conditions. They could be standardized and fitted with air conditioners and HVAC systems, which meant that a lot of those traditional features went away. And the problem is, of course, that this meant not only did you have increasing urban sprawl, it also meant that you had an exacerbated urban heat island effect, whereby cities heat up faster than the surrounding countryside. And of course, the more you do that, the more you have to install air conditioning, and the more of these you end up with. And this brings us back to the problem that we started with, which is the production of greenhouse gases from the energy system. So we can see that energy modernization is a creative imperative. The problem is that what we're faced with is we don't really understand very well how you move from the curve on the left here with current technology to the curve on the right with new technology. We have this sort of representation of what happens, but actually when it comes to generating the change, we're really not so well informed, and we're particularly poorly informed about not just about how you introduce the new, but how do you get rid of the old. What are the obstacles to energy modernization? I mean, we've had massive improvements in the performance of solar cells. We've had massive improvements in the performance of wind turbines. Unfortunately, though, these are intermittent sources, and when they're not actually generating, there's still demand for electricity, so we need to find some form of power storage. And the means that we currently have for power storage on a grid scale are really not very good. What we tend to do is what's illustrated on the right here, which is pump a lot of water up a hill during the daytime when the sun's shining on our solar cells or the wind is blowing through our windmills, and then let that water out at night or when the wind isn't blowing and run it through hydraulic turbines to generate electricity. Another way is to put gas underground and then under pressure and then let that escape at night. So we've got missing bits of kit, okay? We've also got, although I say we've had massive improvements in these solar and wind technologies and others, they're still not cost-effective competitors with oil and gas and coal. And the challenge I said earlier, part of the problem here is timing. The standard approach that has been adopted to try to bring about this technological change has been the idea of imposing a carbon price. And indeed, in Europe, the mechanism for doing that has been not simply a tax, but the idea of a carbon market. And the way that's supposed to work is you bring down the cap on emissions, the cost of the emissions goes up. That stimulates consumers to demand of producers ways of bringing down the costs of non-carbon technologies. So you have a demand for innovation, and then you have a response to that innovation to bring down the cost curve of the non-carbon technologies while you're raising the cost of the carbon technologies. And at some point out in the future, those cost curves intersect and you're supposed to get a very rapid change from your existing technology to the new technology. You move from that curve on the left that I showed you just now to the curve on the right. Now, I'm willing to believe, I'm a gullible guy, I'm willing to believe the neoclassical economists, that we could, given enough time, develop an economically efficient and environmentally effective global market in carbon. The question is, do we really have the time? And even that stretches my credulity a little bit, because I think that the economists fundamentally misunderstood the politics, and they fundamentally misunderstood that to get a sufficiently high rise in the carbon price to stimulate this innovation in any meaningful time frame would in fact produce a political backlash. And if you think about what has happened when we've seen, you know, what happened with the fuel escalator tax in Britain, what happens in France when diesel goes up and the truck drivers blockade and all the rest of it, what happened when Clinton tried to introduce even a 5 cent a gallon gas tax in the 1990s, we've found that that has not been politically viable. In which case, my suggestion is that what we have to do in order to be able to do something fundamental in terms of technological innovation in a timely fashion is actually to bring down the cost of the technologies first. And the way that I and my colleagues in something called the Hartwell Group have suggested we do this is actually by a vanishingly small carbon tax. A carbon tax that is so small that people don't notice it. But what you do with that tax is what's important, which is you put it into a fund which you use to fund technology R&D. And a small, a tiny carbon tax could raise something around about $80 to $100 billion a year, which by coincidence, it turns out to be the amount of money that in the Wrong Trousers paper we proposed that the US ought to be spending on energy R&D. But we derived the number from a very different source. We said this is if climate change is a strategic threat to the welfare of populations, we should be spending as much on energy R&D as we do on military R&D. And it turns out that's what the US spends each year on military R&D, at least in the open budget. I don't know about the black budget, probably more than that. That's not military expenditure, that's just military R&D. The US at the moment spends roughly $8 billion on energy R&D, but most of that actually is in nuclear and coal. So very little of it is going into the new technologies. So we're looking at a different scale here. What kinds of technologies would we want to fund? At what stage in the development? And I would say that we're talking about funding technologies not that are 3 years away from being competitive in the marketplace. Venture capitalists will take care of that. And we're not really thinking about stuff that's 20 years away because that's basic research. And in any case, that's probably not going to come online in a sufficiently timely fashion to affect emissions by mid-century. Carbon concentrations, more to the point, by mid-century. So we're talking about technologies that are probably something like 3 to 12 years away from potential maturity if they have sufficient investment in them. And we know, in fact, from the way in which military R&D occurs, that if you do put this kind of investment in, you can get very rapid technical innovation and very fundamental technical innovation. It is a very uncomfortable truth for many of us who perhaps are not entirely comfortable with the military, that in fact the process of military procurement and the commissioning of military technology has been one of the, if not the, most significant driver of most of the technology that we take for granted as being innovative technology in the 20th century. You're talking about things like the interstate highway system in the United States, you're talking about the internet, you're talking about things like GPS, I forget what the price of the early GPS systems were. They're about the size of a suitcase, and they cost something like $100,000 a piece. Now we all have them in our cars in really just a few decades. The other thing about this approach is that it has incentives in it for China and India to participate, whereas they have no incentive to participate in the Kyoto architecture. China has become the world's largest producer of wind turbines. India is a hotbed of information technology, you start to put those together and you think about smart grids and so on and so forth, there's a huge potential there. And even climate skeptics that you encounter, particularly climate skeptics in the US, will respond positively to the idea of energy innovation and energy modernization if they see it as contributing to increasing energy security and you don't talk to them about climate change. And I'm not interested in people's motives in this instance in getting them to support technological innovation. I'm interested in actually the outcome. So I'm not going to force them to say, you've got to acknowledge climate change. If you'll get on board with an innovation policy strategy, I'm not really particularly concerned about what your motivation is. But that's all very well for introducing the new technology, and you've seen where we've been going here. We still have this problem of eliminating the old. This is the world energy mix from 1970, projected through to 2030. And as you can see, there's not a single technology there that we use less of in that time frame. And in fact, if you project this back another 70 to 100 years, you find that, in fact, that is the case, that we have increased the use of every single energy source except one, sperm whale oil. Okay, and it wasn't because we were running out of sperm whales. It was because kerosene came along, it was cheaper, it was easier and safer to produce, and here's the critical thing, you could burn it in the same lamp. So this is reminiscent of what I was talking about earlier with respect to chlorofluorocarbons. If you can have the ability of a technological substitute and a transitional technology, then you have the possibility of a very rapid change. I would argue, actually, that the Toyota Prius is a transitional technology. I don't seriously expect to see hybrid cars around in 10 years' time. We'll have electric cars and we'll have gasoline cars still, but we won't. But basically, the hybrids, I think, will have passed their usefulness. It is a way, I think, of creating a transitional technology. There's a big argument going on at the moment about natural gas. As some of you may know, there have been huge shale gas finds in the United States. Only just one of which, the Haynesville shale, comes out of the ground in Louisiana, could power the entire United States energy needs for the next 30 to 50 years. And people are saying, well, this is a disaster because it means now we won't see investment in renewable technologies because people will just want to build gas turbines. It may be a disaster, or it may not be, because actually building gas turbines may not turn out to be a bad idea. It depends how long you continue to burn gas that comes out of the ground, rather than gas that you synthesize from as biogas, or possibly even burning hydrogen. But the point is that a gas turbine is a very versatile piece of equipment, which you can feed from different feedstock technologies, and there may be an analogy there with what happened with whale oil and kerosene. Unfortunately, we don't know how it's going to turn out, but we do at least need to be aware of and open to the possibilities. So we have to eliminate the old technologies. It's a bit like what happens when you go out and buy a fridge. You go to Currys, you buy a nice new energy efficient fridge, you take it home, put it in your kitchen, and then your wife says, or your husband says, well, what do we do with the old one? Oh, we'll put it in the garage and keep beer in it. And that is, on a global scale, what we do with dirty technology. So in many ways, things are looking pretty bleak for dealing with climate change through conventional mitigation technology, which is the reason why a number of scientists and a number of policymakers have taken another creative and imaginative leap to think about this new set of technologies called geoengineering. Again, as I mentioned earlier about the way in which new technical fields are stabilized from very heterogeneous technical practices, this involves a wide range of things which have nothing in common with each other. So one of the suggestions is that we could put sulfate aerosols. Remember those sulfate aerosols, the ones that you're trading in the EPA sulfate trading program? We put some of those up in the stratosphere. We know this works because actually volcanoes do this periodically for us. And when Mount Pinatubo erupted, we saw for about 2 years roughly a 2-degree attenuation of global temperatures worldwide. So that's something you could do, intervene with a natural system, tinker with a natural system, put those stratospheric aerosols up to act as a big parasol and cool the planet. Another bit of tinkering with the Earth's natural systems that you could do is to actually fertilize the oceans. This isn't to cause cooling through shading, this is to actually pull carbon out of the atmosphere. And the way this would work, according to those who are following up on the idea, is that there are certain areas of the world's oceans that are iron deficient. If you could redress that iron deficiency, it would encourage plankton growth. Plankton would suck up the carbon from the atmosphere, fish would come along, chomp the plankton, the fish poop sinks to the bottom of the ocean, and you've got your carbon out of the atmosphere. Great job. Unfortunately, there's a Indian-German experiment that they did where they actually tried this and the plankton got eaten by jellyfish, which have light floaty poop, and the carbon went straight back up again. But it's still early stages. So those are two things you can do. You can reflect sunlight and you can suck carbon out of the atmosphere. And you can do that by tinkering in natural systems, or you can do it by traditional black box engineering. You could reflect sunlight back by putting a mirror or a series of mirrors at somewhere like the Lagrange point between the Earth and the Sun, or you could build machines, and this is one artist's impression of such machines, that suck carbon out of the atmosphere and put it down into spent oil and gas wells. Now, we do this in submarines. It's hideously expensive, but we can, we do have some technology that suggests that this is plausible. And of course, the putting the carbon down spent oil and gas wells is really carbon capture and storage, but instead of taking the carbon out of a waste stream of a power station, you take it out of the ambient air. And the advantage in that is you can put your carbon capture technology where you've got lots of sunlight and run this on solar power. And you can also do it by the spent oil and gas wells. You could imagine that a country like Saudi Arabia might well actually be a centre for the introduction of this technology. There are various problems, however, here, and this raises another aspect of innovation, another face of innovation that perhaps we don't give sufficient attention to, which is something that was identified in 1980 by the British sociologist David Collingridge as the technology control dilemma. And basically what Collingridge said is, in the early stages of a technology is this point where you would like to design the governance system and the regulatory system to run that technology downstream. You can imagine that the technologies that I've just described, or I should describe them as technological imaginaries that I've just described, they're not real technologies yet, they're things that people are thinking about creatively, but you can imagine that some of those might have some implications for society that we wouldn't be pleased about. Putting those sulfate aerosols up in the atmosphere have the potential, for example, to upset the climate system, and at least according to one model, could cause disruption of the Asian monsoon. So what looks like a very simple, cheap, available technology could turn out to be hideously expensive and disruptive. So you want to know, in the early stages of a technology, what governance arrangements you want downstream. The problem is we know also that upstream, we don't have a very good idea of what a technology is going to turn out like in practice. And most technologies don't actually end up resembling very closely the original idea of the inventor right the way back in the innovation process that we've talked about. So what was Collingridge's solution here? He wasn't just wanting to give us a counsel of despair. He said, no, what you want to do is where you have the ability to make a choice, you want to favour technologies that give you flexibility and reversibility. So you want to avoid technologies where you have technological monoculture, where you're told there is only one technology that can save us or that can do the job. You want to avoid capital-intensive technologies, technologies with very long lead time from conception to implementation. And you want to avoid technologies that make very hubristic claims for what they're going to do. And one of the claims that's made about the sulfate aerosol technology that I mentioned earlier is that this could save the planet in the event that we reach some kind of climate tipping point. You know, and I don't think you can get a much more hubristic claim about a technology than one thing is going to save the planet, especially something as simple as a little sulfur in the upper atmosphere. But you can see how those kind of claims marshal support and mobilize arguments around a particular technology or set of technologies. And the claim about the hubristic claim is one that I want parenthetically to focus on for a little bit before moving on with climate, because it's a frequent claim that's made about new innovative technologies. We were told, for example, that GM crops were going to save the world. What did we get? The flavor saver tomato. We were told nuclear energy was going to produce electricity too cheap to meter. We've ended up with a fairly expensive nuclear waste disposal challenge. The internet was supposed to be the information superhighway, which was going to be the great leveler, and we got the digital divide. And now we're told the next big thing is nanotechnology, and we're waiting to see what the downside of that is. But what happens in each of these cases when these hubristic claims are made by innovators for a technology, there tends to be a questioning, okay, if this technology is so new and it's so radical, it's so revolutionary, what's the downside? What's the risk? And what happens consistently is a pattern of defensiveness about that technology, which even further undermines confidence in it. So when people started questioning nuclear energy, we were told, no, it's just another way of boiling water to run it through a turbine. With GM crops, agricultural biotechnology, these are just animal husbandry and plant breeding. With nanotechnology, it's just colloidal chemistry. You can go to the Royal Institution in London and see colloidal gold that Faraday put together, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, whenever it was, I forget the exact date. And of course, by doing that backtracking, this only reinforces the concerns that people have about the performance of the technologies. Before finishing, I just want to focus a little bit on adaptation and thinking here a bit more creatively about adaptation to climate change. I think it's fairly clear from what I've said that we are going to face a significant climate impact around the middle of the century unless we are very mistaken about the emissions trajectories that we're on or about the fundamental, pretty fundamental aspects of climate physics here. Let me say, by the way, I think that that climate science is deeply flawed, but I'm not a climate skeptic, because although I think climate science is deeply flawed, it's at least as good as the information that governments regularly make decisions about economic policy, invading Middle Eastern countries, that kind of thing. It's at least as good as the information that firms regularly use for mergers and acquisitions or new product launches. So it's flawed, but it's still very useful. No, because I don't have time. That would be at least another hour. I mean, there are various aspects of if you really talk to climate modelers over a few beers, as I'm sure you have, they will tell you all kinds of problems that mean that the notion that these are simply copper bottom parameterized guides to truth is not the entire story. What I wanted to talk about here is adaptation to climate variability. Because one of the problems that people have in really coming to grips with the adaptation issue, by the way, adaptation was something we couldn't talk about for a long time. It was like talking to American Southern Baptists about sex education in schools. You can't talk about it even because it will encourage people to believe it's okay. So it's this idea of a moral hazard. And that moral hazard concern has now shifted largely from adaptation to the geoengineering technologies that I was talking about a moment ago. But we already experience climate causing adverse impacts on society. It's climate variability. What happened in New Orleans wasn't caused by increasing hurricane intensiveness. It was caused by failures of the levees, technical failures, and poor adaptation to climate variability. So part of the argument here is that if we adapt much better to climate variability, that we will actually start to improve our situation to handle climatic change. Indeed, there are claims that are made that extreme events are increasing, hurricane rates are increasing. There does indeed seem to be a very slight increase in hurricane intensity over the last 40 to 50 years since the Second World War. But if you go back and look at the hurricane record over 100 years, that trend disappears completely. Disappears completely. What is absolutely clear, however, is that the costs of wind and water damage from climate change have just skyrocketed over the same period. Now, what's the cause for that? People know where this is. That's Miami Beach. That's Miami Beach in 1925. Okay, let's see that again. Miami Beach today, Miami Beach 1925. Most of that damage from hurricanes in the US is caused from putting expensive infrastructure in silly places, building these huge walls of glass and concrete on barrier islands which previously actually offered populations protection from hurricane impacts and so on and so forth. So asset, thinking about asset relocation is one thing. Another response that we resort to, and this is, of course, the Thames Barrier, which I think is an absolutely beautiful structure. But it's limited because, of course, it's a solid barrier, and there are limits to the extent that you can actually extend something like this. So the question then becomes, well, when this seems to be at the limits of its usefulness, what else do you put in its place? So we can do technological innovation to protect particularly treasured areas, and it's my projection that, in fact, the United States will never let Manhattan Island go underwater, even if it does mean building a barrier across the Verrazano Narrows, which would be one hell of an enterprise. But unfortunately, poor people aren't able to resort to those kinds of technical hard shell technical protections. This is a picture of the Sundarbans in Bangladesh. These islands actually move from year to year with the floods of the Ganges Delta. And Bangladesh imports rubble. It imports rubble for building roads and buildings because it doesn't have enough stone. So the local natural resource for building that kind of hard-edged protection is highly limited. Now, it's interesting that actually in the recent floods in Bangladesh, most recently, the loss of life was almost negligible. And that's because, in fact, the Bangladeshi government had instituted an early warning system and was actually able to get the population mobilized and to move out of danger when those floods occurred, which is a huge improvement on the cyclone problem, the problem they had in the cyclone in the around the same time as Hurricane Andrew hit Florida. But the poor are also inventive themselves. You don't have to rely on governments to do this. Some of you may recognize this phenomenon. These are the floating villages that you find in Cambodia, particularly on the Tonle Sap Lake in Cambodia, where you have very high levels of fluctuation of water level. You find them in Vietnam, you find them in China. And so we can actually learn from the spontaneous creativity of marginal societies, every bit as we can learn from the high-tech sector. And we're already seeing the emergence of both imagined and real floating communities. This is a design for an apartment complex in the bottom right-hand corner here. This is actually a one house of a whole housing complex that's already been constructed in the Netherlands with the view that this will rise and fall with fluctuating sea level. And we're increasingly, I think, and this is where I'm moving now into the more fanciful part of my talk and closing, the way in which there is an interesting syncretism between art and technical innovation. The work you see on the top left here is a piece of work. It's a photograph of work by Thomas Saraceno, who is an Argentine artist working in Germany. And his work is on what he calls cloud cities. And he's envisaging going even further than we've seen the floating infrastructure idea about cities in the air. Now, this is obviously highly fanciful, but it does actually have some relationship to some of the kinds of structures floating on the water. And I would argue that encountering art of this sort actually does challenge our creative imagination to think about what are the kinds of ways in which we can both innovate in technology to counteract climate change, but also to adapt to it. And we're seeing increasingly, I think, the creative look at old technology. And I said at the beginning of the talk, if you remember, that innovation is very much about harnessing the old and rediscovering the old. You can see here, for example, at the top, the Queenslander House. This is a traditional architectural design in Eastern Australia, very well suited for the climate there. The house is on stilts. You have air circulation around it, lots of natural cooling, very wide eaves on the roofs for providing shade. With the air conditioner, people started filling in the bottom here and making it a two-story house. A lot of them regretted it when the floods occurred last year, by the way. But you can see how this design, which provides for a lot of natural cooling, is now being taken up in modern architecture. In the bottom left here, this is the building on the campus of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. utilizing a lot of the same principles. On the right here, the far right, this is a wind tower from Masdar, which is Norman Foster's project in the Middle East, which was inspired by these structures here, which are traditional wind towers that you find in that part of the world, towers that are built up into airstreams that are above ground level and conduct cooling air down. In the Foster version, there's a lot of modern aeronautics that have gone into the design of the new version, but very directly inspired by the traditional spontaneous creativity. Again, here you can see in the middle another of Saraceno's installations. I had the great pleasure of working with Thomas actually at the Tate Modern about 18 months ago in some presentations about climate change and art, which you can find on the web if you're interested. I think what he's trying to convey here is the idea of actually taking vegetation up off the ground and getting us to think about new ways in which we can incorporate it in built structures. And you can see here with the green roof on the left and a design on the right here for vertical gardening. There are people who make some rather wild claims that we could actually feed ourselves with vertical gardening. I think we're a long, long way away from that technically. But nevertheless, it's an intriguing part, I think, of the rethinking, the cultural rethinking about climate change that has to take place if we're really going to achieve the kinds of technical transitions that are necessary. So I will leave you with a final thought. Climate change is not simply a technology or policy design program problem, as you might have concluded from this lecture, but my intention is to convey that it's actually a challenge to the creative imagination. Thank you.